Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as so he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Nothing, that's what it amounts to, they say. A black void waiting down the road for us one day. We're all there ain't nobody gonna carry us home, and there ain't no place where the angels roam. Stuck in traffic on Beverly Glen, running late, meeting Hollywood friends. Don't even know how the shit show ends.
Tim Heidecker is a prolific and gifted musician, comedian, writer, actor, director, and podcast host, currently based in the state of California. Well known for collaborative comedy projects like the duo Tim and Eric, the web series On Cinema at the Cinema, and his Office Hours podcast, Heidecker has also worked with great musicians for albums that house his sincere and accomplished rock songwriting. His latest record is a wonderful one called Fear of Death, which found him working closely with Wiseblood's Natalie Maring, her colleague Drew Erickson, and an amazing band that transformed Tim's sketches into cool, fully realized orchestral songs. Fear of Death is out via Space Bomb Records on September 25th, 2020, and Tim returned to this show for a chat about its creation, sound, and lyrical themes, how all of the other versions of Tim Heidecker he has created over the years relate to the musician Tim Heidecker, his own favorite songwriters, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Sloan, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 566th episode of Creative Control, featuring the ingenious Tim Heidecker, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
Nothing, that's what it amounts to, they say. A black void went down the road for us one day. But it's all right, don't listen to me. I could be wrong, let's wait and see. But if you see me in heaven, just let me be. If you see me in heaven, just let me be.
Hi, Tim. How's it going?
It's going pretty good.
Nice. Where in the world are you?
As always, Glendale, California. Although I believe the last time I spoke with you, I might have been somewhere else on tour. But yeah. It's been sitting at home for since March.
Yeah, how's that going for you? I detect some, and I'm not sure exactly when your wonderful new record, Fear of Death, was made in relation to that, to the pandemic, I mean. Maybe we'll get into that. But in general, first of all, yeah, how are things going for you pandemic-wise in Glendale, California?
Okay. You know, we are lucky. We haven't had any, you know, medical issues in our home, and you know, we've been playing it pretty safe, but not, I don't think, I'm not like overly paranoid about it or anything, but I'm able to keep busy. I have my studio and office hours and writing and meeting some people for lunch and that kind of thing, and starting to get a little productive or busy, but it's certainly not normal and not the best situation.
Yeah, you do seem prolific though. Office hours in particular, I mean, that must feel good that you have this outlet, and also, I mean, obviously social media. Like, I feel like you're, Tim, I feel like you're very present during the pandemic, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I have projects that some, the record and Moonbase are both things that we made last year. And as you know, sometimes the process of getting things out the right way takes quite a while. Mm. So it's sort of timed out nicely that there's this, you know, to use an overused and ugly word, content, that is, just in the can. So we are glad that's coming out, but it hasn't been the most creative in terms of actually physically making a lot of things, although Office Hours does, I think, generate a lot of funny stuff, and it's a very affordable way of doing comedy and talking to people and stuff. So it's been a real blessing to have that kind of, but right before I went on tour, I kind of looked at Office Hours, which I've been doing for like 3 years, kind of off and on. And I had an old friend of mine, Matt, who I had never really done anything creative or professional with. We've just always been really close. But I knew he liked the show, and I knew he loved podcasts and radio. And we grew up kind of listening to Howard Stern together. And I was just like, do you want to come in and just help me with this and produce it and figure out, because it feels like it's good, but there's just nobody kind of running it. Mm. And he just kind of just dived in deep and said, yeah, I'll let me get in there and figure out what to do. And And that timed nicely with me coming off the road and having this project to look forward to. Like, how are we going to actually do this the right way? I don't know if it's gotten better or worse, but it's gotten more like less stressful and more kind of, more just pure fun. So yeah,
anyways, I mean, for what it's worth, I think it is. If I may, it does seem better, or like you've yeah. elevated it, and also Vic Berger is involved as well. So you've got
Doug Lucenhat.
Yeah, so you've got your crew there, and so that's good. You've got that outlet. You mentioned the production timelines. So I alluded to this earlier. Fear of Death was made well before the pandemic, and we were all feeling stir crazy and wanting to run away. Is that fair? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it was made last year, sort of the spring and summer of last year. So it was not. I mean, things have not been going well for a while. You know, I'd say for the past 4 years, and for other people longer than that. Mm. But you know, so there was a little doom and gloom in the air, but nothing like, you know, it was kind of impossible to predict this year, although some had. But you know, some of the content of our tour also kind of hinted at the themes of this year. I don't know if you're able to catch this year's Tim and Eric tour, but there were certain themes at the end of the show that were about, literally about this disease that was spreading throughout the theater. And there was this idea of quarantining people and an antidote and all this stuff. And
yeah.
So there's all these, and then the record, yeah, the fear of death, all these things kind of took on new meaning this year, which, you know, you just kind of roll with that.
Yeah. Well, I will say I missed the Tim and Eric tour because my family and I moved to Edmonton, Alberta from Ontario.
Oh, wow.
In January, and then everything went to hell. I had all this.
We didn't pass through Edmonton this time.
No, would you ever consider?
I don't know if you know this. My wife and her family is from Edmonton, so I've been there a few times. I've never done any performing there, but I know it quite well.
I vaguely knew this because I met you and your wife in Calgary many years ago, and yeah, she mentioned the Alberta. I did, obviously. My wife is from, the reason we moved is my wife is from Edmonton. So Tim, our wives are from Edmonton. Is all what I'm getting at here.
What a small world.
It is a small world. So I hope that if things recommence, you may, in fact, roll through town with some kind of show, because there are allusions to Canada on your record, and those struck me as well. So, yeah, in terms of the soothsaying, prescient content that you've been up to, are people pointing this out to you? Like that? I mean, you've obviously figured this out yourself. When you think about some of these songs, there is this sense of trying to get away from a way of living, I think, on this record. But it's not, it wasn't, it seems to me you were trying to get away from America. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's not an active pursuit necessarily. I mean, it wasn't when I was making the record. It's just, you know, they're the kind of thoughts that pass through your head in the middle of the night, or you know, occasionally, and you know, I draw on those kind of thoughts, I think, in my writing, because they're a little more dramatic or interesting.
Hmm.
You know, and I don't know if it's a reflection entirely of how I always think or where my goals are or anything like that, but there's a certain character involved, you know, a certain like inhabiting a character a little bit when you're writing songs. And
yeah,
some of them, I think, you know, overall you could say, well, there's a better picture of that guy, you know, but obviously if I'm singing like I'm done growing, you know, that might be a feeling I'm having at that moment, or I find it's kind of a clever or interesting thing to sing about, but you know, I don't know if I would go up on a in front of a judge and put my hand on a Bible and swear that that's how I owe. I don't know if that's always, you know, a full reflection of how I think about everything.
You invoked the notion of singing as a character, and as I was driving around Edmonton yesterday, I was thinking about some of our past conversations. I think we've talked about the fact that I find it interesting that you've created all these different iterations of Tim Heidecker in your comedy life. And I as I was listening to this record, I thought to myself, I wonder if Tim thinks of this version of Tim Heidecker, the songwriter, the singer, as maybe the closest to the real Tim Heidecker. There's something about songwriting that, in particular on this record, it feels very confessional. It feels very factually based, if you will, whereas the other iterations that I allude to, those are always sort of send-ups, I think, of culture. You use Tim Heidecker as an avatar to satirize things. So my question is, do you feel like when we listen to you sing and when we hear your lyrics, are we getting closer to the real Tim Heidecker than we might be in some of your other expression?
Yes, I would say so. I think in the past few records, those are closer. Yeah, I think, I think this record has more straight autobiographical moments in it, and in Glendale as well. I think the last record, What the Broken Hearted Do, actually did have some autobiographical stuff, but it was a little couched in a style of a song that's more literal, kind of heartbreak and breakup. But there was also, you know, me reflecting on, you know, friends whose relationships have changed, or my you know, parents had gotten separated, and you know, so there are real things happening in my life. On the new record, there's things about, you know, feeling a little, you know, feeling uncomfortable going to the movie premiere of the movie Us in the song Nothing. Like, yeah. So I certainly draw on things from my real life. And as I get older, I think I kind of tapped into this in Glendale, that as I get older and have more life experience and have more momentous moments happening where, you know, like children and family responsibilities and things, those I can draw more inspiration from that. So yeah, I just kind of stopped, in the music. I don't necessarily think of myself as a character in that. These are just sort of, you know, I like making, first of all, I love making music. I love writing songs, and there's a musical component to that, and finding a catchy, poppy kind of tune. And I think if I'm going to sing something, I'd like it to be, you know, have some kind of, carry some kind of weight or some kind of point of view. So and this didn't feel like a place to be necessarily satirical or a parody of something.
You have been meta with your musical, like a little bit. There was a premise to the last record, right? Like a kind of concept.
Yeah, I think I think it was a little confusing because it's not. It was presented as, you know, not an autobiographical breakup record, and that might have just been a little. That didn't mean it was a parody of a breakup record. It was just that this is maybe more of a character that is going through a breakup. But it's not like I've never gone through a breakup. I mean, these are all feelings I've had before, or so it's not a parody of anything. But
right.
I like records in my personal life. I like records that feel thematic, that have that sound like there was consideration. It's not just like a random collection of songs, but they're, you know, sometimes they're more literate or literally, you know, a conceptual album, or they're at least sort of, you know, a song cycle about a certain subject matter, and everything feels kind of connected. So
yeah.
Whenever I'm going into making a record, I'm always keeping that in mind. Like, what is this about? What am I trying to say? How can we musically make it feel connected, and that kind of stuff? So, I'm just an old-fashioned record guy like that. I think like albums are cool when they all work together. And
well, yeah, I mean, I know you take your music very seriously, and I take it. I don't think it's particularly meta or satirical, but I think you and I are, we've discussed this before as well. I think you and I are both pretty big Bob Dylan fans, and he's a bit of a trickster. So I think sometimes when you, for me anyway, having sort of delved so deeply into his work, I kind of always assume he's putting me on in some way. Like, oh, well, that photo is kind of a little joke or something. And you have this interesting position, I think, like Steve Martin had as well, but maybe your situation is different. People might assume you're putting them on, that the things you're doing are send-ups. Like when I think there's like some Grateful Dead allusions on here, and some other sort of sonic callbacks. Subtle. I mean, this is very original music to me, but I'm sure there are people who are like, "Is Tim putting us on? Is this another bit?" Like, do you experience that?
I guess a little bit. It's not as much, maybe any more than as it was. After, you know, I've done a few of these records now, and I think that there's a common understanding that there is not like this isn't some kind of prank.
Yeah, yeah.
So a few of people, and you know, I think I certainly pay attention to and am aware of like YouTube comments and that kind of thing. But I just feel like, you know, that's not the best polling of people's perception, because if somebody's making that comment, you know, we have to acknowledge first that they're making a comment on a YouTube video. That already lowers my perception of them as a, you know what I mean?
A legitimate source of criticism. Yeah,
it's just sort of like,
yeah.
So, but there are people, of course, that say like, where's the joke here, you know? But, you know, I think reasonable people can kind of grapple or can kind of conceive the idea that maybe I'm not always, you know, churning out gags and goofs.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it does not, like, the last two records in particular, like, it does not feel that way at all. And yet there are really funny little lines on these records. Like, there's still humor here. Like,
sure.
There's the joke about I'm just going to paraphrase here. You know the lyric, but it's something about, I think I said hello to the same guy twice.
Yeah.
That's just funny. That's just like very, very funny. And
yeah.
And so I like that you're applying, your humor is here. Your cleverness is all here. And that must be nice for you to like have these different outlets. You know, you mentioned some of the things you've been up to in the pandemic. Like I imagine you feel fortunate to have these platforms, music included, to sort of just express yourself.
Absolutely. I'm glad that, you know, I take the lyrics pretty seriously. I don't spend a terrible amount of like rewriting and re-editing and stuff, but I do like when the lyrics can do a little bit of everything. They can be kind of sad, or they could be, you know, funny, and those are all things I in my own, you know, I love people that can do that, and there's all kinds of people that do that really well. But you know, Paul Simon's very good at it. Obviously, Randy Newman and Warren Zevon, yeah. Joni Mitchell. You know, like, lyrics are there. Like, they're half the equation, you know. So I always try to make them count.
Yeah. No, and that comes across. By the way, earlier I sort of ascribed you with Bob Dylan fandom. It's been a few years since we spoke. Are you still a fan?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. You keep up with him. I was just listening to his new Theme Time Radio Hour, and your friend there, John C. Reilly's.
Oh man. I haven't heard it yet, but John sent me that part of it, and we talk about Bob all the time, and he was just like, he couldn't have been more proud to have done that. And we were both just like giddy that he got that little experience. So, yeah, we talk about him. He's still he's still the god for me.
I thought of you when I heard John, to be honest, because for those who haven't heard it yet, like, it's a little bit of a bit, it's a skit sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's a phone call. And to be honest, because Dylan can be so odd, I'm like, did they stage this? Did he actually talk to Bob? I actually thought that.
I doubt it was like a live thing. That would be my guess.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. It kind of comes across with that little bit of stilted acting. Anyway, it's great. And, it's all wonderful. I'm glad that you're still a Bob fan, because I think when you hear the whole show, you'll enjoy it as well. Let's talk about the making of this record. It's a really collaborative affair. It seemed to happen kind of happenstance, right? Fear of Death. The words I received about the record were that you kind of talked about it on a Thursday and were recording by a Monday. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a, you know, fortuitous moment in everybody's life where we were very available and down. There was some downtime, and I met this kid, Drew, Erickson, who was a really accomplished arranger and piano player, and he was a fan. He had heard Natalie and I on my podcast, and we met after a Wise Blood show, and he came up to me and was like, you know, if you're ever interested in recording, I could put a band together, and maybe you and Natalie could do a couple songs. And I said, sure, dude, and we exchanged numbers, and over the weekend, you know, the next day, really, he was like, okay, well, send me some songs, because I've got a band and the studio there. We can do Monday and Tuesday. And I kind of went through my folder, and I knew I wanted to do Fear of Death and song Come Away With Me and song Say Yes to Me, and then another song called Someone Who Can Handle You, which I felt was like, ooh, this could be a really nice ballad, like a duet ballad that felt almost like something from, like, that song Shallow. I was like, I wonder if I could write a song like that, you know, like a big, like, could I write a hit? Which I think is, I've heard other songwriters kind of always talk about that. They're like, I'm going to try to write a hit. And, you know, just to not like, and it never will, it won't be a hit, but it, you know, just sort of that idea, like a big song, like a big.
Now, why can't it be
song.
A hit?
I don't know. It could. Who knows?
All of these songs could be hits. I'm being sincere. Like, it's a really thoughtfully arranged record. Like,
well, have you heard hit? Have you heard popular music? I mean, there's just not. It doesn't. You know, it's. I don't know.
Yes,
I don't even know what
to
describe it. But
yeah.
Maybe, you know, in 1975, it could be a hit. But who knows? Maybe I think anyway. So I brought those songs. I sent them all demos and. I remember driving to that session on Monday feeling like, is there anyone even going to be there? Like, I didn't have a feeling of, like, that this was all figured out. I think it was partly because Drew and Natalie, they're such pros, and everybody else, they're just like, this is what they do. This is their life. Like, they just kind of go in the studio when there's these things happening, and it's kind of like not that abnormal. So I get there and everyone's there and they're come in, and, you know, this drummer Stella from this band Warpaint, all these like really accomplished players are fans of mine too. So there's sort of this equal admiration going around, and everyone's like, cool songs, man. Like, these are great. I can't wait. And Drew had written up some lead sheets, some chords, and we just started bashing them out, and they started sounding really good pretty much right away, and that was that.
So for you, as you say, they're fans of yours, probably particularly of your comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have moments of imposter syndrome? Does anyone have this, like, do we belong together? What's going on? How quickly do you diffuse that? Is this going to work tension? Do you just start playing to show them you know what you're doing? How does that work?
Yeah, I don't recall anything like that. I just kind of felt very, very comfortable. I didn't feel out of place. I was, you know, I'm not a great musician. I'm not a great guitar player or piano player. I can play enough to write and to show people things. But so it was very much like, you know, here are the bones of the song, and now Drew can help kind of structure it more musically, and then I can just sing and kind of give my feedback and show them ideas and stuff. So there isn't really any kind of competition or anything like that. It's very much like they're there to help.
Yeah, I don't view it as competition. I just think that sometimes, I'm sure there was like, is this a lark? What's going on? What is this going to be like? You know, those kinds of thoughts. And
I remember Natalie, like, after a few days, we did the first couple days, and then there was some time off, and then because we had these four songs, and then, like, the next session that we met a few months later, it was kind of like, this is a serious record. Like, it was, I don't know how many people were really paying close attention to the lyrics or, like, the how it would all play off each other, and there was a little bit of a, I think, you know, kind of sat in a little later that, like, this is kind of heavy in a good way. Like, this is cool.
You mentioned having about, I think, four songs as demos. How did the rest come about? And did anyone else contribute to lyric writing or even input on that stuff?
I think after the four songs, I was so energized and so excited about that that session that I started writing a lot more with the intention of getting back together for another couple of sessions. So I had, I think right after the first, like, I think we did Monday and Tuesday, and then like probably Wednesday or Thursday, I wrote nothing and, sent it off to Drew and Natalie with my, that's always a little scary. You're sending them like a demo, and it wasn't really that finished, and it wasn't, there was something different about it. It was kind of more of a poppy, it was like a little faster, and it was kind of, wasn't as pretty as it ended up being. It was just a little bit of a sketch. But, you know, you text them that and then kind of wait, and you get sort of just like a, awesome. You know, let's, and so, or, you know, like, love it. That's, you know, so you're sort of like, yeah, okay. And then we met on Friday of that week to do some kind of pre-mixing, like just, and doing a little overdubbing, just the three of us. And after we got that done, I was like, do you want to try to record nothing now? And it was a little bit of like, well, we have a couple hours. It's getting a little late. Do you want to, like, you know what? Sure. Can we do it? And there was that sort of like stepping over to the other side of like, you, we could have easily been like, ah, fuck it. Let's just do something out. Yeah. Let's call it a night. But we committed to it and figured it out. And Natalie added a couple chords and, we just sang it. We kind of did it live in a way, piano and vocals. And so then after that, there was a longer period and I went on some trips with my family over the summer and wrote Backwards and a couple other of the songs on the record, Property. And then we met again in that same studio that we met before. And then the only other song that was different from that process was the last song, Oh, How We Drift Away, which we said, oh, if we're going to do an album, it would be kind of interesting and fun to co-write something together, and let's try one of the classic songwriting dynamics, which is me writing you lyrics and you singing them to a tune that you wrote. Yeah. So I just sent essentially kind of a poem that I probably had some music in my head for, but didn't send that along. And then, you know, that's how that last one came about.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's very fascinating closer as well. You know, as you're talking about this process stuff, I'm thinking about your work as in comedy, in that so much of it, particularly of late, is trusting the moment, improvising. Do your instincts change as a musician to sort of? I think you mentioned like having a couple hours, maybe to work on nothing, and I can't recall if you said that was done in that time, but
yeah.
I think you have an experience of trusting the moment and moving on. Maybe that some others don't. You know, some people overthink things, or particularly in a studio environment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about those two impulses, like a comedy improvisation, trusting the moment, and musically the same?
I guess it's a combination of the practicalities of the situation and kind of having done it long enough now where I can feel fairly confident that, you know, it's either, it is what it is, and it's, and there'll, you know, there's never a desire to make anything the best thing ever and obsessing over, testing it or focus grouping it and, you know, like overanalyzing what it is. It is what it is. So, yeah, like, and then it become like the first point, there is never time and money to analyze or obsess over.
Yeah.
Anything. And I don't enjoy doing that. I like the ideas, and that's why I'm doing it. So to kind of question them and put them under investigation feels like a self-defeating almost.
Yeah, but you will rewrite lyrics, or you mentioned, I think nothing was a bit faster, like things will change.
Yes, certainly there's always a development period or a the process, the writing period continues pretty much until it's done, but overthink. I guess I don't like. I wouldn't take home a song finished and then rewrite the lyrics and go in and record it again because I had a different idea.
Yeah, and I think again that must be born of your instincts as a live performer as well. Like, move on. Like, we did it. It is what it is, kind of thing. Let's keep going. I'm sure that's in there.
Definitely. Yes, definitely.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess normally, if things were normal and you could, you might take a record like this out on the road. What do you do now, Tim? What do you do with... I will say, for those who are interested, I ordered my vinyl copy of it yesterday.
Please.
And I assume you'd like other people to do that too. Particularly, it's a nice Beatles cover on here, by the way. I didn't even get to that part. There's an interesting arrangement of Let It Be that I want to ask you about in a moment. But yeah, let's focus on my first question. What do you do?
Yeah.
What are you doing right now, Tim, to get the word out about this record?
Well, you know, all the usual things. I'm doing these kind of interviews, and that's about it. And telling people on my show and social media. Yeah. And I am sort of relieved that I don't have the pressure of having to tour it, A, because I just did a tour with Eric, and doing a music tour for me is it can be difficult because, you know, it's hard. You know, there's certain people I love playing with, and a lot of them are more focused now on being studio players, and I've kind of also graduated from the road.
Hmm.
And you know, to go out, I feel like also, you know, there's going to be a backlog of people going out, and once people can go out, and I don't want to I feel almost a little guilty taking up any of that real estate, you know, and I always think like, well, the best version of all these songs are on the record, you know? So like I've done a few of these, like, you know, live acoustic stream things. And it's like, you know, we went into the studio and recorded them multiple times and picked the best version of that song. So I always feel like it's a little weird when people play live on these TV shows and stuff. I mean, it's fun to see everybody, but. It is this weird like tradition that started, you know, with the Ed Sullivan Show or something.
You think the recorded version is the definitive version? Like, you know, I alluded to.
I remember that kind of struck me. I heard John Lennon talk about this. He was talking about like seeing live music, and he was like, you know what? I grew up with the records. The records were what I knew, and that's what I'm closest with, you know, when it comes to like Elvis or, you know, Buddy Holly or whoever they were listening to.
Yeah, Little Richard, like, sure, yeah.
Little Richard, it's like, it's never as good live than it is. Some people maybe, some people, they're live performers and that's really where they shine most or something. But, you know, it takes a lot of work for me to get something really good that's, you know, I feel enough to, you know, I feel strong enough to play to the world. So that doesn't necessarily happen in real time.
Well, going back to trusting the moment, and, you know, I was alluding to Bob Dylan earlier, who kind of famously plays songs that people are like, I don't know what song this is. And it's like a Rolling Stone or something, and they just don't get it. And to me, discovering that, going to see him when I started to see him, and other bands who did things like that, I was like, that's kind of cool. Like the song, the recording is the day. The song lives its own life after that.
Yeah, I dig that. And I would think like I've done that when I've played live. We play things, we arrange things a little differently. Not dramatically like he does.
Yeah.
But I do think that it is more interesting to play live and to not try to replicate the album necessarily.
Okay. All right. Well, I did ask, we have to go shortly. I just wanted to ask you a couple of things here quickly. One, Let It Be. I alluded to it. You mentioned John Lennon. It's a mm-hmm. Paul song, but still, let's, what's the deal with this arrangement? Why is this on the record per se? By the way, I don't say this disparagingly. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Tremendous Beatles fan over here. Just curious about that.
Yeah. Well, Natalie and I, after we did this benefit show, well, I did a benefit show and she came and sang a couple of our new songs last year, and we were backstage and we were warming up and stuff, and we had a couple hours to kill, as you do when you go and sound check for a benefit that's going to be 4 hours long and stuff. So we were back there and we just got in this sort of a music game where we were playing Beatles songs with totally different tunes, totally different arrangements.
Melodies, yeah.
And it's, yeah, and it's really hard, actually, because you just kind of associate those two things together, you know. And but we did Let It Be, and then that one kind of stuck when we were doing it, you know. And we're like, this is kind of a fun way of doing Let It Be, a song that I, you know, frankly, as a huge Beatles fan, I don't need to hear that song
sure.
as much as maybe other ones, you know. It's yeah. a little overdone, but it is kind of beautiful. And the way we did it, we felt it was kind of a fun new take on it, and we did it on Instagram, that like live. Backstage, and put it out, and people seemed to really like it. So yeah, we were in the studio, and again, it was that thing where like, oh, we have a couple hours, do you want to try to do one more? It was that kind of back and forth, and that was one that seemed kind of easy to do, and easy for the band to pick up, and they did quickly, and we just laid it down. And it felt like in the sequencing of the record, I like that there's this little, you know, dip, and kind of mellows out into sort of this little mini country suite there with Little Lamb, and
yeah.
it just felt good, you know.
It's lovely. I just wanted to ask you about it, so I appreciate you fielding that. Tim, if you want people to learn more about Fear of Death and anything else you're up to, where would you send them on their computers and phones?
Well, you know, timheidecker.com has links to the record. Timheidecker.com links you, if there's a music tab there, I believe it goes to timheideckermusic.com.
Okay.
But, you know, it's on all the streaming sites. Whenever this comes out, it comes out on Friday, the 24th of September. So, yeah. And you know, Office Hours is a podcast that you can subscribe to. And that's all I can tell.
Okay. Tim, if we were to go out on a song from Fear of Death, can you choose one and maybe tell us why you chose it?
Well, I'll say Backwards. It's like I said, one of the more autobiographical songs, and there's a nice Canadian reference in there. It's last summer we were staying in Vermont for a week, and then we flew from Boston to Kamloops in the Canadian Rockies.
Oh, yeah.
And went up north into Sheridan Lake, where my father-in-law has a cabin. And I just I used a lot of that in the song. And one of the things, I was kind of writing the song about how the future looks kind of grim right now, and thinking about looking at my kids and what world they're growing up into, and how that was different from when we were kids, and how the future seemed exciting, and now the future seems kind of scary. And one of the things I noticed up there was on the lake, these bald eagles had moved up mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, geez, this is like the greatest analogy for the world right now, or for my country right now, because the bald eagle is the most sort of, it's our bird. It's like the American symbol, you know, and even they have now split for the North, you know. They've moved to Canada.
So given all your Canadian ties, Tim, how would you consider moving?
I don't know if I can handle the cold. You know, I've grown too accustomed to. But it's getting too hot down here, and now California, where I live, for some reason now has mosquitoes, which we've never had since I remember living here.
Mosquitoes.
We have fires, and we just had an earthquake the other night, which woke me up. So. You know, it's tough. It's we're living as Steven Tyler might say, we're living on the edge.
Well, you're always welcome, if I might say, on behalf of the entire country.
Thank you.
And for all my fellow Canadians, look out for a nod to our national anthem in this lovely song called "Backwards" by Tim Heidecker from the new album Fear of Death. Tim, it's always wonderful to talk to you, and I always appreciate your time. Best luck with everything in the future.
Thank you, Vish. Take care.
Children are swimming in the water, mm-hmm. playing and laughing, being golden, no way of knowing. We're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving back. We're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving back.
grass is getting browner, trees are falling in the heat, water's getting drier, people are hurting, who are we fooling? We're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving back, we're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving backwards, we're moving back. Don't it make you cry? Don't it make you wanna lay down on the ground and die? Hey baby, sun is setting on the good times, oh no. Funny, when I was younger, we loved the future, but the future knew we were moving backwards, we're moving backwards.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
That was very nice to have Tim Heidecker back on Creative Control this time. The 566th episode of this podcast, which is part of the Entertainment One Network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and Spotify and what have you. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, you've heard about it, you just can't track it down, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you still use Facebook. Why are you using Facebook? Why do we use Facebook? Why do I still have a page? It's my fault. I shouldn't have started this sentence. But still, you can like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative. or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more gets you exclusive content, access to exclusive audio content from my archives. Maybe if I haven't published them already, I might share some cool stuff I've done with Tim and Greg and other people like that over the years. But, you know, there's a bunch of stuff there already. And if you don't care about that extra stuff and just want to support the show with a $2 a month donation, $5, $6, you know what the numbers are. Just go to patreon.com/creativecontrol and make your flexible monthly donation today. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. They provide in-kind support for this show, and I like them, so I'm mentioning them to you now. As always, my dear friend Jim Guthrie lets me use some music for this show. Jim has collaborated in the past with Nick Thorber, Nick Diamonds of Islands, who I believe is friendly with Tim Heidecker. I mean, I know they are. So there's a little connection there. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. His music's fantastic. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Tim and for maybe checking out the back catalog of episodes for Creative Control. And if you like what you heard today, feel free to subscribe to the show, follow the show, tell your friends about the show. And that would be awesome. Or you just, you know, hit stop now. We never have to talk again. You don't have to deal with me ever again. It's whatever you want to do is fine by me. But, you know, I'm going to still be here, so feel free to stop by. I must leave you, but I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.